Let's explore this theme of fear in a little more detail, a little more fully. This aspect of being human that we all know, that we all suffer with. Start at a very simple level, ask a very simple question. What actually is fear? What actually is fear or anxiety? So we all at one level know the experience, but it's worth actually kind of dissecting it a little bit. What goes on? What's the experience of being afraid? Well, usually there are some body sensations, and I touched on this earlier. The heart is going faster or pounding, maybe butterflies in the tummy or knotted in the tummy or something, just a sort of fluttering or quivering energy in the body. Can be much stronger than that as well, but some sensations going on at the physical, at the bodily level, generally unpleasant. Generally not pleasant sensations, unpleasant physical sensations. And because of their unpleasantness, a reaction to them, don't like, a reaction of basically aversion, wanting to get rid of them. So one important aspect of the experience of fear is body sensations, being unpleasant, and then our reaction to them. So I'm dividing, in a way, dissecting the experience of fear, not for the sake of being sort of anal or overly petty, but actually because it provides some clarity and also different approaches how we can work with this. Instead of fear being overwhelming, you can actually learn to have it be something we can work with. So body sensations are unpleasant and reaction to them. Thoughts, often, not always, but thoughts are also part of the sort of soup of fear. Thoughts, they're often, have you noticed, in relationship to fear, they're often future-based thoughts. It's often something in the future, even just a few seconds in the future, but often the thinking associated with fear is directed towards the future. So thoughts, and included in that sort of aspect of thoughts is a whole pack full of assumptions, oftentimes not all seen. I'll go into these later. Thoughts and assumptions, often not conscious and not explored. Again, the kind of thinking that goes on when we have fear is generally not pleasant. It's unpleasant. It's not nice, kind of comfortable thinking. It's unpleasant. Because of the unpleasantness, there's reaction to it. Okay? So body, sensations, unpleasant, reaction, thoughts, and reaction. Third aspect is a little more subtle and a little more hard to describe, but it has to do with the way that the mind feels. So the body feels a certain way, but the mind too can feel a certain way. In a sense, sometimes the mind feels very contracted, tightly contracted. It's almost as if our brain has shrunk to the size of a pea. You might have had this if you're performing something and you suddenly get up there in front of the audience and you look out and you and everything just, it feels like you can't think. The actual space of the mind is shrunken. Or it feels so inside. There's a constricted mental space. As human beings, generally speaking, we don't like that. Again, we feel that as unpleasant. Mostly we like a relaxed, open, spacious kind of feel to our mind. It's a little more subtle, but I'm talking about the texture of the mind itself, the texture of awareness. This is something we can learn to notice. It's a constricted mental space, and again, it's unpleasant. And because of that unpleasantness of the constriction, we react to this. We react to that. Okay, so there's these three aspects and their related reactions. How can we work with fear? How can we work skillfully and really helpfully with fear to really begin to kind of chop down this sort of poisonous tree and really, really do something about it in our lives? So, when there's fear, something to point out, and I'll go into this in more detail as well, when there's fear, we're usually afraid of fear. We usually have fear of fear, and that turns out to be very significant. I'll come back to it. But what it means is that oftentimes we don't take the trouble, we're not particularly practiced at really just being with fear itself, and being with the textural experience of fear itself. We're not very practiced, we're not even that interested usually in just feeling the vibration of fear in the body, giving mindfulness to the sensations of fear. This is the place that we start. This is the place that we start with fear. Actually, to take one step back, when there's fear around, it has this uncanny, often, it has this uncanny tendency to take up all the space. So it feels like in the body that everything is consumed with fear. Or perhaps we don't think that consciously, but it's as if we get sucked in a little bit to the whole experience of fear. Very worth taking some moments or even minutes to deliberately put the attention somewhere in the body where we're not feeling fear. So there are typical places where we usually feel fear in the body, you know, the tummy, the heart area, this sort of area. But there are other places that are less typical. Earlobes? I don't know. Someone's yet to tell me they feel fear in the ear. I'm sure it can happen. In the middle of the fear, actually put the mindfulness, put the attention somewhere where there isn't fear, and just rest there and experience the absence of the sensations of fear. Just for a little bit, partly to kind of reassure the being that fear is not taking over everything. It's not like a, you know, metastasized, whatever the word is. So that's really, really useful. Toes, maybe? End of the nose? I don't know. Somewhere where there's not fear, just to kind of calm down the cycling of the process a little bit and see that it's not everything. But then the flip side is also true, as I said, and we need to learn, really learn, it really is a skill, how to bring this bare attention of mindfulness, this simple attention, and meet the actual unpleasant sensations of fear themselves. So we don't really want to go there because they're unpleasant. What would it be to just hold them in mindfulness, to just meet them with mindfulness? What does it actually feel like? And this mindfulness of the sensations of fear in the body. Now, as I said, we're not really practiced at this, so this is something that we do practice, and slowly, slowly, gradually, we develop our capacity to do that. We develop our capacity to be with and kind of accommodate the sensations of fear in the body. So it's something that we can get, in a way, more and more skillful at doing, more and more able to do. So when there's fear, that's kind of the first port of call, really checking in with the body and just being with the bodily experience of it, allowing the bodily experience, but really interested in what it feels like. I'll go a step further and I'll say, sometimes when there isn't fear and you're sitting in meditation, perhaps quite calm, to actually sometimes deliberately sacrifice your hard-earned calmness and drop a couple of pebbles in of what it is that typically brings up fear for you. Why? A couple of reasons. One is the clarity of the calmness enables a clearer seeing, of course, and we can kind of see it begin to ricochet in the being and have its effect in the sensations. But also, sitting in meditation is what we could call a safe space. I don't have to do anything when I'm sitting in meditation. I don't have to perform anything. I don't have to look good. I don't have to act on anything. I don't have to decide anything. It's a safe space. It's so using the calmness and the posture of meditation to begin deliberately, sometimes, deliberately trying to practice with the mindfulness of the sensations of fear. Okay. we don't need to act when we're sitting for half an hour, 45 minutes. I don't need to act. All I need to do is sit there and see if I can suffer a little bit less. That's kind of a description of meditation. All I need to do is that. I don't need to act. One thing that we're lacking with fear, generally, most people are lacking with fear, is confidence in the face of fear. So we're afraid of fear. Fear comes up, it goes like this, and we go and run the other way. Quite uncommon for someone to really feel confident with their capacity to just open up and accommodate those unpleasant sensations of fear. But we can develop a real confidence with fear. So it's just not so much of a problem. It's just some sensations. It's just some sensations. So very important, this mindfulness of the sensations, and really deliberately working on our capacity to do that. So the second aspect that I want to go into, and this is really, really, really pivotal, is what is our relationship with fear when it arises? What is our relationship with fear and anxiety? So usually, in fact, almost always, we are aversive to the experience of fear. We want to flee the unpleasantness of the experience of fear. Okay, we're afraid of fear. We don't like it. We want to get rid of it. We want it to go away. That's our relationship, typically, our typical sort of unpracticed and unexamined human relationship with fear. Very normal, very understandable. Unfortunately, we can't quite just see that and say, okay, and kind of get away with it. This fear of fear, this aversion to fear, the fleeing of the fear, actually is not an innocent bystander. It makes the experience of fear increase. It's like throwing gasoline on fire. It's not a neutral thing. To have that kind of relationship with the experience of fear increases it. Increases it. Snowballs it. Makes the experience of fear increase, and it also makes it feel more difficult. It's part, we could say it's part, this aversion to the experience of fear is part of the constellation of fear itself. It's not like there's fear and there's something else, which is my relationship to it. It's part of the whole snowballing effect. It's part of the whole mechanism of the fear. This is really, really important to understand. What happens when we flee is the thoughts associated with fear actually gain momentum. Again, unfortunately. Here's the anxiety sensations in the body, the unpleasantness, the tummy churning and fluttering and all this. Don't like it. I flee it. I flee it. Where do I go? Upstairs, into the head. Into the head. The energy goes up here. Thoughts are already spinning because that's part of the fabric of fear. I've just injected a whole lot more energy into the thinking, and they just go faster, they spiral around faster. The kind of thoughts that are spiraling around anyway, as we said, are not particularly helpful, and I've just given them an extra dose of energy by fleeing the bodily sensations. And the whole fire of fear just goes more. So the reaction we have is part of the anxiety. It's part of the anxiety. It's not that they're two separate things. If I can learn to take away the reaction, to drain the energy from that reaction of aversion, I will see that fear cannot support itself. It cannot support itself without my reaction of being afraid of it or aversive to it. Some people are nodding. For some, that might be, you know, I'm not sure about that. Not just to believe me because I said, but actually, we can actually explore this in our practice. What happens to fear if I withdraw or quieten even my reaction of aversion and fleeing and fear of it? It cannot support itself. So always in the Dharma, the relationship that we have with things ends up being really, really crucial, really crucial. we might also be, you know, in terms of the aversion, we're putting a pressure on it to be different. We're just putting a pressure on the fear to be different. Don't want it to be this way. We may be judging ourselves, and this is very common. I shouldn't be afraid. I'm X years old, and I've been doing meditation and therapy and sauna and, you know, whatever for decades, and I shouldn't have this, you know, I shouldn't. And there's a self-judging. Sorry. That self-judging, again, it's not neutral. It's a pressure. It's a pressure. It's like putting the fire of fear in a pressure cooker. It's putting pressure on ourselves, and it will fuel the whole thing more. So often, when I have fear, to look carefully, what am I assuming? Or am I assuming that the presence of fear in this moment means something about me or about the level or status of my practice? What am I assuming? That I've been meditating for X years and there's fear, so it means that I haven't got anywhere, or it means I'm going backwards, or it means I'm, you know, whatever. What am I assuming the presence of fear means about me or my practice? Remember, the story I started with, completely innocuous sounding story about the Buddha meditating in the forest, etc., and had a bit of fear but worked with it. It's like, okay, big deal. But then you remember, according to the story, this guy was, it doesn't say exactly when it happened, so this guy was somewhere between 6 years and a couple of days from complete unexcelled liberation. So the presence of fear, even in quite a strong way, doesn't maybe mean so much about where we are, or doesn't mean what we think it might mean. You understand? So really important with this is to watch the judging mind. Is it possible that there can be kindness, that there can really be some kindness in relationship to ourselves when there's fear around? And many of you know the practice we have of loving kindness, of wishing well to all beings, but including ourselves, wishing health and happiness and peace and well-being. This practice of loving kindness, interesting, when we do that sometimes, when there's fear, and actually originally the Buddha first gave the practice of loving kindness as an antidote to fear, but oftentimes a person is giving the loving kindness to themselves, and it's almost like me separate from the fear, me when the fear has gone. Can we actually see that fear is part of our humanity to a certain extent? So in that moment, the me that I am giving loving kindness to is the afraid me. It's the me with fear. That's part of me. It's as much a part of me as anything else. You could say it's not me. You can also say it's part of me. There's nothing that's more me than the fear. It's part of my humanity. Can I make sure that if I'm giving myself loving kindness, I'm actually including that part? So me with fear. But even again, to go a step further slightly, is it possible that we can practice and actually learn to practice giving kindness, offering kindness, so to speak, to the fear itself? Not to me with fear, we do that, but actually offering kindness and acceptance to the fear. What would that look like? How would that translate? So this, I think, is one of the most powerful ways of working with fear. We talk a lot about mindfulness in this tradition, about being present with, about clearly noticing. I just did, what do the sensations feel like? Where are the sensations, etc., in the body? You know, what's their texture in the body? A lot of emphasis on clarity and precision of noticing. What if, as a practice, we explored emphasizing the welcoming aspect or the accepting aspect of mindfulness? So not emphasizing so much the precision of noticing what the sensations of fear feel like, but actually seeing if it's possible to emphasize, overemphasize, emphasize in quite an extreme way the attitude of welcoming. Here's some sensations of fear, and it's like opening up the space of awareness, letting them be there, letting them be there, letting them be there, welcoming, allowing, accepting as fully and completely as possible. Okay? Now, that sounds counterintuitive, and maybe some people are thinking, it doesn't sound, that can't be right. But it's a very powerful practice. What's happening? If I'm doing that, and I'm emphasizing the welcoming, then I'm actually undermining, I'm taking away energy, I'm not feeding this rejection, this aversion of the fear. You understand? I'm actually emphasizing in my practice, in the moment, a different approach. And I'm working on softening the aversion, softening the rejection, welcoming, welcoming. Does this make sense? Yeah? Very, very powerful. Very, very powerful. As a meditation technique approach to working with fear, extremely powerful. It's something that it's a practice, meaning we can develop that as an emphasis or an approach in practice, something that we can really develop. I remember some years ago, I was on a personal retreat at Gaia House, and I wasn't that well physically, I had some health problems, and I had a ticket to go to India and to actually visit the leprosy community of this Baba Amte that I told you about earlier. And I was doing this personal retreat, and it wasn't that well, and I just noticed, you couldn't really even call it fear, it was more just a background apprehension. How's my health going to be when I go to India? And I had been to India 20 years before, just once, when I was a teenager actually, and got very ill, and actually never really been the same physically, never really totally got better from it. And just this background sort of gnawing of apprehension, will it be okay, will it be okay? And this is a few years ago, but by that point I'd been meditating a lot of years, so I had developed quite an arsenal of meditative sort of kung fu tactics to, zap it, and was going through my arsenal, and nothing was working, until it sort of dawned on me, I'm basically trying to get rid of it, and began just in that moment, seeing so clearly, okay, embracing this apprehension, really, really allowing it. And it was interesting, as soon as I did that, didn't take very long, but the whole thing just began to kind of just unravel a little bit, soften. And it was as if before that the fear had strangled any sense of curiosity or joy or aliveness about going to India again and kind of exploring this other culture a little bit. That's what fear does. It strangles the life and the love out of our lives. And it had done that in the moment. And just doing that, it was a little bit like the image sort of metaphorically inside the camera. It was as if the fear was still there at first, and it was like me and my fear, who was this sort of little boy who was a little bit scared about getting ill again for a long time. It's like we were going to go to India together and going to kind of go sit there and check it out. And it was much sort of more inclusive, quite lovely. And actually, after that, the whole thing just crumbled. Okay. So we build fear through aversion to fear and through fear of fear. Okay? We build it. And that's something that we can learn to play with. There's another aspect of the way we build fear, and I want to touch on it. We have some sensations in the body, and then we label those sensations, consciously or unconsciously, we label them fear. Okay? So this is what the mind does. It puts labels on things, but then we react to the labeled package. Okay? So someone earlier in the question and answer period was saying sometimes fear is very close with excitement. I've worked with a few people that actually, after a while, they're feeling into the sensations, working with the mindfulness sensations. At some point they wonder, actually, is this fear? There's some sensations, but something happens when the mind, in its habit of doing, it's part of the function of the mind, slaps a label on fear, and then we react to that whole package, the newly labeled fear package. to begin to see the effect of that. To begin to see the effect of that. And it's something that we can play with. As the mindfulness gets more steady and more strong, in a way, can begin to actually look at the sensations of fear and actually just notice this labeling going on and just see them as kind of two separate things, the sensations and the labeling. And sometimes just withdraw the labeling. Just withdraw the labeling. So are the sensations, we could say, inherently fear? Is it really fear, or does it need me to label it as fear to be fear? Or in Dharma language, say, is it empty? Is it empty? Is it something that the mind is actually concretizing? Okay. It takes a little bit of practice, but all this that I'm talking about is available to us as avenues in meditative practice to really begin exploring. Like, how can I move towards not believing fear so much? Because that's the problem. When fear comes, we believe it completely. Yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. We've talked about these aspects of fear, and one of the aspects being this mental constriction. The space of the mind feels shrunken. A very, very normal part of human being, actually consciousness, not just human, having fear. There's something about this. This is a very interesting aspect of fear, and I want to go into it a little bit. Sometimes in our lives, and I know this very well from the past, and I see it in other people, and people tell me. Sometimes in our lives, we go through periods that unfortunately can be quite long periods, where anxiety becomes a habit. And the energy system of the being, the body and the mind, keeps slipping very, very easily into a kind of rut of anxiety. Sometimes even it's as if the mind just goes there, the body system just goes there, the energy system just goes there, and very quickly afterwards then we say, I must be anxious about something. That is what I'm anxious about. And it's if you watch, you can actually catch it. Sometimes anxiety has become a habit in quite a strong way. Other times it's more subtle, but it's quite common. Now, I want to say a little bit about that. There's a few conditions that kind of make that a lot more likely. One of them, the simpler one to start with, unfortunately, is over-busyness. And we all know this, including Dharma teachers. In stretches of time when we're over busy, the mind is really fertile soil for anxiety to kind of fall into that, you know, U-shaped groove of anxiety. It just falls in there. Something to do with being over busy. Sometimes, you know, we look at our life, there's nothing we can let go of. It's just full, and we just have to find ways of working with that. But sometimes we just look at life, something has to go, because what it's doing is feeding the anxiety as a habit. But there's something a little bit deeper than that, and a little bit more to it than that. Oftentimes I've noticed, and this really isn't the whole story, but I think it's important to mention it. Oftentimes I've noticed with people, and again, in the past, I've seen this in myself. Anxiety becomes a habit for a long period or a stretch of time when there is a climate of self-judgment, an ongoing climate of self-judgment, that again, that's the perfect soil for anxiety to become a habit. This is quite interesting, and I see this in a meeting, obviously hundreds and hundreds of people, I'm talking with them and listening to them. See this over and over. There's some relationship here, not to say it's totally, completely the whole picture, but it seems significant enough to go into a little bit. So you wonder, what's going on here? Why is it that when there's a climate of lack of self-love, of self-judgment, of criticism to self, that anxiety as a habit seems very commonly to be married to that? What's going on? Loving kindness, this aspect of metta I mentioned briefly, loving kindness has the qualities of being calming, soothing, of also being spacious. As we deepen in this practice of loving kindness that we don't even have time to do today, but as we deepen in that, we notice the qualities of loving kindness are spaciousness and calmness. Anxiety, as a quality, the qualities of anxiety, as we said earlier, are the opposite of that. They're definitely not spacious. There's this aspect of constriction to it, and it's, by its definition, almost not calm. Self-judging thoughts, self-critical thoughts, feel to the consciousness, feel cramping and oppressive. I'm a failure, I'm rubbish, I can't do this, you're always messing up. The actual consciousness feels, it cowers, it feels burdened, it shrinks in reaction to that. They feel oppressive and cramping. So can you see, with that kind of climate going on, there it's setting up that same kind of constriction of the mind space, the contractedness of consciousness. An element of that element of anxiety is already present when there's a lot of self-criticism going on. So it's just a small little movement into anxiety. Do you understand? So this has a lot of implications, Just to expand it a bit more, I've also noticed, and again for myself, and I see it in lots of people, certain kinds of fear, and certain very painful kinds of fear arise when there is a shortage of self-love, when there isn't enough self-love, self-esteem, self-respect, self-kindness, self-worth. Particularly the fear of being a failure of one kind or another. It goes right on the heels of that, fearing being a failure. Even more deeply painful, very, very painful, is the fear of discovering that we're bad somehow inside, that something inside us may not really be okay, may be bad, even evil. Something deep, I'm talking about very deep level of kind of existential pain that some people can experience. And again, I have known this from the past. Those kind of fears are very, very powerful and very, very painful. And they go with a lack of self-love. So all this to say, just to point the how crucial and necessary developing love is, and developing these practices of loving kindness and compassion on the path to free ourselves from fear. They're absolutely central. They're really, really a big part of working with fear. As I said, when the Buddha first gave the practice of loving kindness, they were as antidotes to fear. So this constriction of the psychic space, this mental constriction, sometimes what we need to do when there's fear is do something that opens up the consciousness. Actually, deliberately, don't pay attention to the thing of the fear. Don't pay attention to the object of the fear. So this goes opposite to what we usually teach in terms of mindfulness. It's very much about drawing close to what's difficult, being willing to touch it and to connect with it. Sometimes there's such a thing as skillful avoidance. Just don't go there. Just don't put it down for a while. So I live at Guy House, and at the moment, well, actually for a while, on and off, the craze is badminton. And some, we play, a whole group of us play, and some people are very, very good, and some people not so good. And if you're ever on the other end of a court, the other side of the net, of someone who's very good, and they've got you running all over, because it's very hard to be anxious. It's just something's taking your mind off that thing, very skillful. Also with this mental constriction, very helpful, because when there's fear, the mind shrinks, as I said, and it seems that the fear takes up everything. Very, very skillful to just open the awareness, the visual awareness, and even the kinesthetic awareness, to a sense of space. So right now in this room, it's a fairly large room, and letting the awareness go out to space, the corners of the room, the ceiling, the floor, take in the space of the room. Just take it in. Can you feel the actual mind opening up a little bit when you do that? Yeah? Are we still here? Yeah? Okay, I'll take that as a yes. So there's something about that, because when there's fear, the mind shrinks. It gets wrapped up and enwrapped in the fear itself. Everything contracts. Giving the mind a sense of space opens up the context of that fear. So here are these sensations in the body. They're just one thing happening in the space. Again, we're going against the natural movement of fear, which is to contract. That contraction snowballs the fear. So we're doing something that moves in the opposite direction. Really, really skillful. Again, it's a practice. One can get very attuned to the sense of space in meditation, actually deliberately cultivate that. Then it's there. It's there all the time. It's something that one can call on as a resource. Okay. So there's a lot of work to do with mindfulness and awareness and seeing how the fear gets built in situ, in process. Oftentimes in our life, we also, unfortunately, have a habit of being dictated to by fear. Fear says do this, and we do it. Fear says don't do that, and we don't do it. So we flee fear, and we follow its kind of orders. A part of working with fear, part of Dharma practice, doesn't just happen on the cushion. It's actually being willing to challenge fear by doing what it says not to do in our lives. So actually we challenge it by doing. And because fear is so widespread, its tributaries run through the whole of our life, we can find all kinds of situations and possibilities of doing this, opportunities of doing this. Sometimes being on retreat, like when people come on retreat for a week or so, it's a really, really good space. And you begin to see, oh, there's this just fear of what if I don't get enough sleep tonight? And you see this fear operating around how much sleep we get. It's very interesting. Are we willing to challenge that? What would it be? Just one day, say, I'll just take two hours less, 3 hours less, whatever. Just, what the hell? You know, there's kind of, sometimes practice needs a little cojones. Do you know this word, cojones? It's not just about being mindful. Sometimes we actually need to do something with a little bit of oomph, a little bit of, it's like standing up to fear. So, sleep's one thing, food's another. I already talked about food. What would it be to just not eat one day, or don't just miss a meal or a couple of meals, just for the sake of shaking something up? Fear has a way of solidifying the status quo, as I said at the beginning, in ways that we don't even realize in our life. It's operating. It's running through, the streams running through the life. So much is controlled. What about, we could shake it up. We see it in relationship to money. As I said, money is very common. Well, you know, this, for instance, in our tradition, we have this principle of dana, the lovely principle of offering with dana. Most people, there's a fear of giving too much. And the figure comes into your head, and then one just kind of subtracts a little bit. I once remember working with someone who had the opposite pattern. So it's interesting. Fear can push us any way. And I was working with her, and she would give me a lot of dana. I mean, it was really like, wow, this is, you know, very, very generous, which was lovely. But after a couple of sessions, I just kind of went into it. So what's actually, kind of, where is it coming from? I mean, like, you know, where is it coming from? But where... And it turned out that she was really afraid of being perceived as stingy. And it was very, very strong fear. And so she overgave, to the point where she was kind of, you know, then unsure of her own finances, etc. So fear can operate anywhere. It doesn't care. We get it too with sitting practice or walking practice. Like, we get used to sitting for half an hour or 45 minutes, and that's what I do. But what about just kind of saying, what the hell? I'll just sit longer. I'll just go longer. And again, it can work the other way, and we can be sort of fearfully attached to sitting. So I remember being in France, and a group of friends, Dharma friends, were sitting around, and one friend, Dave, was asking people whether they sat every day. That's right, whether they sat every day. And going around, did you, didn't you, whatever. And he came to me and he said, do you sit every day? And I said, yeah. This is some years ago. And he said, do you sit twice a day? I said, yeah, I sit twice a day. And he said, when was the last day you didn't sit? And I had to remember it. It was the day that I was under general anesthetic. And I just, it made me reflect a little bit. It's like, actually, there's a little bit of tightness there. It's like I'm hanging on to something, like precious. So fear can work anyways, but the thing is, are we willing to shake it up? Go a day without sitting. Go, you know, if that's the tendency. Give more if it's, or give less. If, you know, push the envelope a little bit. Not about shoulds, it's about exploring and breaking the ice. So we challenge by doing, we can also challenge through the thinking, through the reflecting mind. How much, what am I believing? What goes unquestioned in my life? What assumptions go unquestioned? And am I then reacting to, without questioning, about myself, about a situation, about another person? This is colossal. It's colossal. There's so much running through our life that goes unquestioned. For example, one of the things I struggle with periodically is Crohn's disease. So I have Crohn's disease, and that's some of you will know. It's a not very nice disease which modern medicine hasn't yet found a cure for. And I get periods when I'm really fine, really no problem. And other periods that you get a flare-up that's really quite nasty. And when you get ill, at least in my case typically, it seems to last at least a year. It's quite a long-term thing. So if you get, you're ill, you're really, it's quite a thing. There's a period of a sort of a week or two where you're kind of in between, and it feels like you're getting ill, but you might go back to being okay again, or it might just snowball and then get worse. That period is very interesting. It's very interesting. I began to notice some while ago that actually there was fear coming in at that point, in that I'm not sure if I'm ill or not yet. And I began to, what's going on here, and what am I perhaps assuming? And I noticed that there were a lot of assumptions here. I assumed that if it was to go ahead and be a full flare-up, that it would stop me then for a year or a year and a half, whatever it is, working, stop me traveling, stop me socializing, stop me having intimate relationships, etc. And that was a kind of not even conscious thought, if you can even put it. It was like a belief system that was operating until I just stopped, turned around to it, and I actually began saying, is that even true? And began recalling all the times that the periods I had been ill, and actually I still did work. It was slower, but I got a lot done. I still did travel. It was more inconvenient, and again slower, etc., but I still did. Still had social life, and I still had intimate relationship. You know, it's like, but somehow it was operating, and I hadn't even realized it was operating. Sometimes it's almost like we need to go to the end of the thought chain, the thought chains that are operating. It's like fear says, don't do that because, and we don't, it just says because dot dot dot, and we don't fill in the dot dot dot. So oftentimes we don't do something, we don't say something, or we don't do this because they'll think I'm stupid, or because whatever. Sometimes it's like we have to turn around and look, stare the fear in the face and question. It's like, so what? So what if you think I'm stupid? So what if you think I'm, so what? So what if you think I'm not, you know, handsome or I'm ugly or whatever? So what if I fail? So actually go to the end of the thought chain and ask these questions, because it's operating as if. So what if I'm tired tomorrow? So what if I get sick and I lose weight a little bit? And sometimes a person is so fed up with living under the tyranny of fear, it's almost like, so what if I die? I actually remember I was living in Boston at the time of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center in 9/11, and as you know, some of the terrorists flew from Boston. And a few days after that, I don't know how it was over here, but a couple of days after, it was mayhem, a madness of fear in Boston and probably lots of places in America. Complete. All the Army and Navy surplus stores sold out of gas masks in like 12 hours or something. Food was going off the supermarket shelves, you know. It was complete, like the whole culture was gripped by this fear. I don't think it was the same here, I don't know, I wasn't around, but it was intense. And a group of us, part of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, decided to hold a peace vigil. And on the day, it was 2 days afterwards or something, and the day that we picked for our vigil, it was, you probably didn't have this either, but there were different levels of alert for prospective terrorist attacks that day. So this day happened, we picked that day, and then it turned out to be a red alert level for Boston. And where had we picked our peace vigil to be? It was, you know, after the tallest towers in New York came down, we picked a patch of green directly underneath the two tallest towers. This is all coincidence. In Boston, the two tallest towers in Boston, which incidentally are insurance buildings. It just says something about fear and big money. But anyway, but it's a sense like, you know, actually I don't care. I really don't care. There's nothing going to happen anyway. But it's almost like, do we really want to live so much under the power of fear? Or it's like, I'd rather actually die than be caught up in this kind of madness. So a lot of assumptions going on. Sometimes, in fact often, the assumptions we have to do with what we think or we believe we need to be happy. This is absolutely huge. What I believe I need to be happy. And I remember, I think it was in the New York Times quite a while ago, I remember reading this article. It was about a high school in New York, in Manhattan. And it was a very kind of pushy academic high school, I know, because I went to one too. And they interviewed some of the boys who were about, I think it was 9 or something, quite young. And they had these exams to stream them for A stream, B stream, C stream, etc. And they interviewed some of the boys, and the level of stress that these little, poor little beings were got was unbelievable. And they interviewed one boy in particular, and he said something like, if I don't do well in these exams, I won't get into the A stream. And if I don't get into the A stream, I won't get good exam results when I graduate from high school. And if I don't get good exam results when I graduate from high school, I won't get into Harvard, which is like Oxford or something in America. I won't get into Harvard. And if I don't get into Harvard, I won't get into Yale Law School, which is like the Cambridge. And if I don't get into Yale Law School, then I'll be on the street. And he just tries step to step to step. Now for him, because of culture and upbringing and family, who knows, it was completely logical train of, we laugh, but the thing is we have those steps too that don't add up. They don't, A does not lead to B. And we need to stare it in the face and actually find that place and say, this does not lead to this. This does not lead to this. So this question of happiness and what we need to be happy is actually huge. It's really, really huge. Why is it, as human beings, why is it that our fear in relationship to the approval of others has so much power in our lives? There's so much fear and anxiety about what others will think of us, how we perform, how we do, what we look like, whether we're intelligent or not. So much fear around the approval of others. Why is that such a huge force in this culture? It's complex, it's very complex, but partly we are so kind of like beggars for the approval of others. partly because we don't have enough inner happiness yet. The resources, the reservoirs of inner happiness, inner well-being and peace are actually not quite developed enough. They haven't gone deep enough. We haven't cultivated them enough and deepened them enough. And so we're beggars. When, through practice and through you know, dedicated practice, we actually do deepen that inner reservoir of well-being and happiness. No question about it, and no question about it being a really, really important part of practice. And as that deepens, we become more confident as human beings. And it's not a kind of cold, I don't need anyone, kind of that kind of thing. It's just that we're more naturally confident. So where does that happiness come from? Where is that? It comes from cultivating beautiful qualities of mind and heart. So we talk about generosity and loving kindness and compassion and mindfulness and insight and equanimity and all these qualities, patience. Talk about them. They are qualities that bring happiness. They are qualities that bring happiness. That's what deepens our inner reservoir of happiness. Taking care of, learning how to cultivate those qualities, immensely significant over a lifetime, immensely significant. So earlier, I just mentioned briefly that in relationship to fear, the thinking associated with fear is often future-based. So fear is often future-based. How will it be for me? Will I be okay? All very normal, understandable, but a question. Do I, as a human being, do we as human beings really, really know, really deeply in the marrow of our being, know how to really take care of the future? What does that mean, to really take care of the future? Do I know how to do that? Do I know what it is that will provide for me my future happiness, my future well-being, my future sense of security? Do I know what leads to happiness? Do I know how to go about cultivating that? It's all those lists that sound so boring that the Buddha went through. These are the qualities. These are sometimes I like to say it's your best, our best possible, investment portfolio. This is really the security. This is the security. That can sound, I know that it sounds that that's naive. It sounds that that's flimsy and has got nothing to it, especially in the times of the credit crunch and all that, and it seems like what's going to happen and da-da-da-da-da. This, it takes a real maturity of practice, quite a rare maturity of practice, to really know and understand deeply, not just like a nice idea, deeply, that this is the best thing to cultivate. This is the best thing to invest in. These beautiful qualities of mind and heart, that's the best possible investment. It's very rare for someone's practice to have that kind of clarity, and even rarer for a person to live that, to live from that, because they're so clear about it, and so sure about it, that they're living that. So how do we take care of the future? It's through that cultivation of the beautiful qualities of mind and heart, and also through our relationship to the present. Also through the relationship to the present. And if the relationship to the present has interest and care and kindness and wakefulness and those qualities, investigation, mindfulness, then it's the present. We're taking care of the present. We're taking care of the present, and the present unfolds, and the future takes care of itself. If those things are there, then one really sees in one's life, one really, really sees in one's life, there is a long-term draining away of worry and anxiety in one's life. Really, truly, a draining away of worry. Worry about money. How will it be? Will I have enough? Worry about security. Worry about maybe being lonely. Will my partner leave me, get fed up with me? Will they, you know, die on me? What will happen? these kind of fears, you know, normal, taken for granted human fears, the life, it begins, they begin to dissolve from the life more and more as we have this investment. Okay, I want to finish with something, because I think it's almost time to end, but I want to finish with, there were a few things I wanted to say, but I don't have time, but all fear needs this sense of self, this sense of ego. All fear is in relationship to the ego, it's me. And so seeing the, what we call in Dharma language, the emptiness of self, ends up being very crucial. And I just want to put that to one side and just mention that. It's always a very central part of the deepening of Dharma practice. And I want to talk about another kind of emptiness. We tend to believe that there is a thing or a situation or an event that's coming up or about to take place or whatever, and then there's fear. Like there's that thing over there and there's the fear. And we tend to believe that they're separate. There's the thing and here's the fear. And we believe that they're separate and kind of independent. But that's not actually the way it is. It's not really the case for all things, that there's an object that we're aware of, and then my reaction or relationship to. They're actually mutually interactive, mutually dependent. So we can see this with fear. It's interesting. We notice how fear colors our perception. It colors our perception and our thoughts about a situation, about an object, about an event. So the presence of fear is coloring the perception. And you can see this, you know, it's dark and there are some shadows and you see a monster and a big, you know, nasty thingy. the fear is coloring the perception. So that's obvious in a way, it should be obvious, but we need reminding of that. But it goes deeper than that, it goes much, much deeper. The same principle goes much deeper. The mind is always colouring and building the present moment. It's always colouring and building the present moment. This present moment is always being seen through the mind, and that mind is always in a certain state of mind. So the mind, in any moment, is always colouring, building, shaping the present moment. If I believe that there is a present moment that exists somehow outside myself as something real and independent of the way the mind is looking at it, if I believe in an independently, inherently existing present moment, just that belief will give rise to fear in the future. There will be fear of the future, to borrow the Buddha's analogy, as sure as the wheels of the ox cart follow the ox that pulls it. It can't help. If I believe in the present as being something real, there will be fear of the future. I have to really look into this deeply. The present, we say, is empty. It's always being coloured, built, shaped by perception. Always. The past, too. You think back. Think back on my high school. Great, we had such fun. And I think back, oh, I was so oppressive. And you think back, very good ones, relationships. Past loves. And you think about, she was really lovely in one mood, and then another mood, what was I thinking? You know, vice versa, you know. The past is empty. It's empty of inherent existence. It depends on the mood, the mind, the state of mind, the way perception is working in that moment. The future is the same. The future is the same. The future is only going to become the present, which will become the past. Emptiness of what we call present, past and future doesn't exist independently. The more I see that, the deeper I see that, in a way that's like chopping down the roots of fear, at the root of this poisonous tree. I'm chopping it right at the base of the trunk. When I really see that very deeply, that this world of appearances doesn't exist in the way that it seems to. In the way that it seems to. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it doesn't exist in the way that it seems to. then I can't really believe in fear. The whole mechanism, the whole basis of what fear is resting on, I can't really believe in it. Sometimes we have fear in life because we see life in this very solid, very real seeming way, and that's normal, it's part of the human predicament. But then I start, and that's all I see of life, and I start, of course, trying to make deals. We say make deals with samsara, make deals with this world of appearances. And I look for my contentment, and I look for my perfection, and I look for my happiness within the world of appearances, and the seemingly solid world of appearances. I haven't seen beneath that quite and known something else. And I just let go of that over-investment, and a lot of the fear just drains away. I'm going to stop there. A lot of approaches, obviously there's more, but many, many threads to pick up on here. Lots of different levels and angles and ways of approaching fear. And the beautiful thing is, for us as practitioners, is they're all available. They're all available. Fear is something that we can really learn to work with actively in our practice and see it lose its grip over time. Okay. Long talk. Thank you for your patience. Let's have a walking period now, and then Gary and I will debate as to the end. You'll hear his bell. Okay?